Strap on your parachute. It's time for What Goes Up with Sarah Ponczek and Mike Regan.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Ponczek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg, and you can think of me as the Louise to Sarah's Thelma.
You know, I love how I don't have any warning that these are coming, Mike. It's maybe every 3 weeks, every 2 weeks, every 5 weeks. You just throw them in there.
I like to gauge the reaction.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Well, this week on the show, come next week, President-elect Joe Biden will become the 46th president of the United States. Our guest this week has worked in senior economic and trade policy roles under five different U.S. presidents, and he spent 25 years at Goldman Sachs. He'll walk us through what the new administration's policy proposals could mean for both the economy and markets.
And as usual, we will finish the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. Sarah, I'll give you one teaser. Once again, my craziest thing in markets is Bitcoin related. I know a lot of listeners crave that Bitcoin content. And for the craziest thing segment, it's a deep well to go to, for sure.
I'm going to go ahead and say I did have a listener reach out to me on Twitter, and I have a feeling that your crazy thing might be the same as his.
All right. You may think so. You may think so. But I think it's going to be a curveball. But before we get to that, let's talk about the important issues of the day. As Sarah pointed out, our guest this week has one of the most fascinating resumes I think I've ever read. Five different U.S. presidents, from Nixon all the way up to Obama. Sarah, I think the way you define yourself in this day and age is by the company you keep over Zoom. And I'll give you an example. My last Zoom call was with a bunch of guys I went to high school with. And it was a Saturday night. I think a guy's had a few drinks, maybe. One guy fell asleep during the Zoom and started snoring. And if you know how Zoom
honestly,
works.
Honestly, that might be a talent. Good for him.
But if you know how Zoom works, as we all do by now, the microphone and the video follows who's ever making the noise. So we'd be trying to talk and catch up, and this guy would start snoring, and he'd dominate, and then we'd have to wait for him to get his snore out. And then we start talking about it, and we try to rush it in, and then another big snore comes and would have to go. Our guest, on the other hand, has a much better Zoom story for us. He was recently Zooming with the foreign minister of China. So hopefully no one fell asleep and started snoring on that Zoom call. But we're very happy to have him back on the show. He is, as Sarah mentioned, just a really phenomenal, interesting career. Long time at Goldman, several really interesting White House jobs. He is currently managing director at Tiedemann Advisors. His name is Bob Hormats. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be on the show. And I enjoy Bloomberg. I particularly enjoyed it when I'd get up in the morning at 6 a.m., come in and drink a triple latte.
We all need our espresso these days, Bob.
Or to go to espresso, to go on Tom Keene's show. You needed at least three espressos or three lattes to get up to that level of proficiency and energy that Tom exudes.
Right. I'm still not ready for Tom after that many lattes. So I don't know. I think you need the lattes and a resume like yours to talk to Tom at that hour, Bob. So, but let's talk about that. I think China, the relationship with China right now, I think is at such a fascinating point, obviously, with the change of the administration. So tell us about that Zoom call. I hope no one was snoring, but also, what's your sense of sort of, how Beijing is viewing the relationship with the U.S. as we sort of turn the page on this White House?
Well, there are different levels in this relationship. One, clearly, President Xi Jinping has aspirations of Chinese leadership of the global economic order and perhaps political order of the first part of the 21st century, and really wants China to play a global leadership role and help shape the global political and economic order of this period. And in part over the last several years, because the U.S. has really not played a very proactive role in shaping the global order or in supporting alliances or international institutions, the Chinese have seen the opportunity to take advantage of this opening and to exert leadership. So that's really part one. Part two is that Xi Jinping has strengthened the role of the Communist Party in China. He is clearly one of the most dominant personalities and strongest leaders China has had since the revolution in 1940, the end of the revolution, the declaration of the People's Republic of China in 1949. You know, there was Mao, there was Deng Xiaoping, and now we have the very powerful leadership of Xi Jinping. And he wants to not only ensure the strength of his leadership, but the continued strong role of the Communist Party. And three, he is clearly intent on developing China's role as a global technological power of the first order in AI, quantum computing, 5G, any number of things. He feels that China was passed over because of its own internal weakness and because of the West sort of leaping ahead in the last two industrial revolutions. He wants China to be a leader in the technological revolution of the 21st century. And that means competing very hard with the United States and putting a lot of money into this competitive effort. And there's certainly a greater degree of nationalism in China than before, and a lot of tensions with the U.S. over intellectual property protection, how to deal with businesses, trade secrets, a whole range of things. But the last point is that the Chinese also, and this was emphasized by the foreign minister, also want to be able to work with the United States in certain areas where there is the potential for collaboration. Certainly, there's been a history of cooperation on medical issues. Chinese doctors work in virtually every hospital in this country. China is working on advanced medicines, including vaccines and therapeutics. China also wants to play a major leadership role on environmental issues. And if the U.S. now under Biden wants to regain its leadership on environmental issues, we're going to have to find some way of working with China, as the Obama administration did. And then there's the financial area where, if you go back to 2008, the financial crisis of that era was resolved in large measure because of cooperation between the United States and China, the People's Bank of China and the Fed, the U.S. Treasury and the Chinese Finance Ministry worked very closely together. So it's a competitive relationship. We're dealing with a country that is far more competitive in far more areas than the United States has faced at any time during the post-war period. And we have to figure out how we can strengthen our own competitive capabilities if we're going to compete with China. And that, I think, is one of the things that President Biden will want to emphasize.
So what's the expectation, do you feel, on how the Biden administration is going to go about walking that line between competition and cooperation? I think of the last 4 years, and clearly tariffs had an effect on the economy and markets. We've heard of stock delistings back and forth and back and forth, whether or not those in the U.S. can invest in Chinese companies. What do you think the Biden administration is going to target here?
Well, I think that the Biden administration's tone vis-a-vis China will not be as strident as the Trump administration's tone. But I do think that Biden and both Republicans and Democrats and the business community in general want a tougher line on China than the United States has displayed before on such things as intellectual property, the rules with respect to data privacy, how foreign companies are dealt with, a whole range of things, far trade secrets of American companies. So I think he's going to not revert back to the softer period of the past, but will take a harder line. I don't expect an immediate withdrawal of some of the tariffs, and I don't expect another grand round of trade negotiations, a so-called round two. I think he will try to get China to comply with the commitments of round one. But I do think two things will happen. First, the United States has to decide what it really wants from China. It can't just present a whole menu, a so-called Chinese menu, and say, we want you to do all these things. We have to figure out, preferably on a bipartisan basis, what the priorities are from our own point of view. Second, how we work with our friends and allies. And I think this has been a deficiency over the last several years, that we have so many trade hassles with our friends and allies using various parts of the Trade Act or Trade Acts, that they are not in a mood to really work with the United States on China, even though many of our objectives vis-a-vis China are similar to the objectives of other countries, like Germany, for instance. The Chinese bought this big robotics company called KUKA. And then the Germans wanted to buy a large comparable, not the same, but comparable Chinese company. The Chinese said no. And of course, the Germans said, this is, you know, not fair. It's not a level playing field. So I think that if we're smart, we'll not only develop our own sets of objectives, but find out what other countries' objectives are and figure out where there are ways of working with other countries collectively to convince China to adhere to certain rules and norms and practices. And that means working with Japan, South Korea, the EU, and countries such as India and others. And related to that, I don't think the Biden administration is going to immediately, in part for domestic political reasons, there are Republicans who don't like it and Democrats who don't like it. That is to say, a new TPP or the new TPP. I don't think the United States is going to come back and join that right away. But I think there are elements of the current TPP that the United States can support, and the United States can certainly work together with members of the new TPP on vis-a-vis China on issues where there is common ground. There's a certain common sense of mutual objective. So we don't have to rejoin it, but we do need to work with it in the near term. In the medium term, I think there'll be a lot of talk about the United States rejoining some kind of TPP-like mechanism, because it shows cohesion economically in the Pacific, but it also demonstrates that the United States is back as a major player. Instead of pulling back on the economic front, it is collaborating in a more effective way on the economic front. And the TPP is a vehicle that was designed to do that. And since the United States pulled away from it, we have sort of left that vehicle to others. The Japanese have done a great job of leadership of that, but the United States still needs to play a role in it.
You know, Bob, so many of President Trump's policies were motivated by the trade deficit. And here, you know, as he prepares to sort of ride off into the sunset, China's last trade report, it looks like their exports, their trade surplus is at a record high. I mean, I guess you can look at some of the U.S. data and see that our exports to China as a percentage of exports have risen significantly. And obviously, the virus has just really clouded these numbers pretty severely. But I wonder, you know, when you look back on everything that was done to shrink that trade deficit, I wonder, A, will it work eventually once we're through the other side of this virus? And B, is that sort of hyper focus on the trade deficit a good idea from the American perspective? Is it sort of our main problem, or is there you know, is it kind of overblown to focus on it so severely?
Well, I would put it this way. It'd be nice to have a trade relationship with China that is more imbalanced than currently. But the fact is that trade deficits or surpluses, in this case deficits, really are and economists will have models that demonstrate this, the difference between what we save and what we spend. Because if we spend a lot more, the economy grows and we import more from abroad. And then we have to borrow the money to make up the difference, which is why we're able and why we have to, in effect, sell more foreign bonds. Sell more bonds abroad. And that essentially means that we are increasingly in debt, not only to our own people, but if we're going to be borrowing more and more money, as we probably have to do to get the economy going and to deal with COVID relief, then we have to get the money to pay for the treasury. Someone has to buy these treasuries, and it comes from abroad. Whether it comes from China, which has not been buying a lot of treasuries lately, or other countries like Japan, which has, we're going to have a financial deficit and a trade deficit if we do not generate a higher level of savings than before, and if we continue to borrow a lot of money as we are now. So I'm not particularly worried about this in the near term, but I think over the medium term, the key point for me is not so much the numbers of the deficit, but are we competitive in the key areas that are the essential 21st century technologies that are going to be important from our own economic point of view, and other countries like China consider them important from a Chinese point of view. So it's our competitive strength in these new areas of technology and in manufacturing in general, and in services that are critical to me, not some numerical metric, but our competitive strengths. And that's where we have to put more money into science, technology, mathematics, physics, and all the so-called STEMs to make ourselves more competitive in a very competitive world. And and that means investing in education, that means more training, that means people who have not had the benefit of training in technology get opportunities to do that, which means improving the school system, not just the very high quality schools like Bronx Science and Stuyvesant here in New York, but strengthening community colleges, strengthening schools, and getting people energized about mathematics and physics and science and technology, because we're competing with a lot of very competitive Chinese. If we want to compete, we have to have competitive workers and researchers and others in the United States. That's the challenge, more than a given number.
Can you break down the thinking on that a little bit more for us? The idea that you can have a higher deficit and more spending as long as you are competitive. Is it simply the return on investment?
Well, it gets complicated because if you have large deficits for a sustained period of time, you're building up a lot of debt to other countries, and of course, you have to pay that debt. Now, at the moment, it's not so hard to do because interest rates on treasuries, which is what foreign investors tend to buy a lot of, that interest rate's quite low. When interest rates start going up, as now many predict they will with all this borrowing, then the debt servicing becomes a bigger burden. And it becomes a bigger burden to the federal government because it crowds out other programs. And it means the United States has to, in effect, pay more to other countries that have lent us the money, which is money that's not spent here.
I think what Bob is saying is that my English degree did not really help this nation become more competitive. I should have majored in accounting. I knew it. Or
STEM.
Or science or something. STEM. Now, Bob, you mentioned the fiscal deficit and the federal debt and who's going to buy all these treasuries. I mean, obviously, the Federal Reserve is the big buyer these days, you know, and sort of the notion of modern monetary theory has really picked up a lot of steam lately. People say, you know, don't fret over the debt and the deficit. If you issue your own currency, you can always pay it back, that sort of thing. I'm guessing you're not in that camp, I would assume.
Well, I you know, it's a time issue more than anything. I do think that we need, while we're in this period of COVID and a lot of people's lives are being disrupted, a lot of companies are closing down, and there's a lot of pain, the cities and states, and I want to add this as an important underlying point. We're going to need legislation that helps individuals who are harmed by the shutdown and by COVID. We're going to need to help companies of a wide range of companies, in fact, but particularly small and medium-sized businesses. Many of them are being forced to shut down. We're going to also need to help cities and states. They're absorbing a huge amount of the burden, you know, Medicaid and the states. This is a very expensive proposition. And these states, unlike the federal government, the states can't print money, and many of them are forbidden to have deficits by their constitutions. So they are having to lay off people. They're having to cut back on services. That, in effect, is particularly harmful to low-income people. It is in New York and disadvantaged socioeconomic groups. So I think if money needs to be spent, obviously it should be spent wisely, but if money needs to be spent now to deal with these issues, it should be. And I'm all for President-elect Biden, soon to be President Biden, coming up with a bold spending program for COVID relief for state and local governments and for other things. And I'm also of the view that infrastructure is critically important. Eisenhower understood this after World War II and the Korean War. He launched the Interstate Highway Program. Why did he do this? Obviously, we needed new highways, but he wanted to be able to create jobs for people who were coming back from the wars. So we're really now in a similar situation where a lot of jobs have been lost. We've got to create new jobs, and we need to deal with people who are hurt by COVID, whose companies are being forced out of business, who are losing their jobs, and state and local governments in particular need a lot of help. And that should be a critical part of this bill, because these states and local governments, if they lay off people and they cut back on services, there's going to be a lot of social unrest in many of these cities and states. So that's the current environment. As I said, it was a timing issue. Over the longer term, there needs to be a way of paying back at least some, I don't expect all, but at least some of the money that's been borrowed. Now, I don't think this is going to be easy, and I don't really know that there are easy ways of doing it. In the past, it was you create a lot of inflation, and inflation enables the federal government to get more money because you people move up in the tax bracket, and then they can help pay off the debt. But I think for the moment, the reality is we're going to have a large debt for a long period of time, and big high growth expectations or high inflationary expectations or very substantial increases in taxes are probably not likely. And therefore, we're going to probably have to learn to live with these deficits and these debts and perhaps deficits, but certainly debts. And the Fed, as you pointed out earlier, is going to be putting more and more paper on its books, is going to be, in effect, printing more money. So the Fed is going to have a very, very high balance sheet for a long period of time. And on modern monetary theory, whether one believes in it or not, and it's controversial, the reality is the Fed is forced into it. because it has to land at low rates because people need the money and they can't service debts at high rates, federal government included. So the Fed prints money, in effect, buys bonds with at very low interest rates, which effectively is printing money. And that's going to happen for a long time. If the Fed starts raising rates or rates start going up, all these people who are leveraged to low rates, companies, individuals, homeowners, are going to start having to use a lot of the money they make to repay debts. It'll slow the economy down. So the Fed actually is sort of forced into a position where it can't really allow rates to go up too much because it would slow the economy down very quickly. And then the federal government would be, and state and local governments would be paying out more money, which means other programs would suffer. And I'd add one caveat, however, and that is these low rates are very painful to savers, particularly the elderly, because they, you know, they thought, gee, if I've made $200,000 in my life, I have $200,000 in savings, I put it in the bank or I buy treasuries, I get a nice interest rate. That's what they thought several years ago. I get a nice interest rate of maybe 2 or 3%. That's what a lot of people would have thought several years ago. But it turns out now that the interest rate that they get is, you know, a fraction of that. And so for savers, particularly conservative, elderly people who've saved a lot of money, they're getting so little in return for their fixed income savings, particularly in treasuries, but also in many corporates, you know, high-grade corporates, that they're suffering. So the low interest rates may be and are good for the overall economy, and the spending is very good for people, disadvantaged people in cities and states, and we need more of it. But the low interest rates can be very disadvantageous to conservative elderly savers, and we have to bear that in mind. It's a big cost for elderly conservative savers.
All right, Mike, I think it's that time though.
It absolutely is the time, Bob. This is our fun time of the show where we talk about the craziest things we've seen in the market this week. Sarah, what the heck? I'll get started with a one that came in from a listener. And again, you can call in your crazy ideas to us, your crazy things on the hotline. You can send them to us on Twitter. The absolute coolest way to do it is to send it to us over the Bloomberg terminal. And that's what Steve Kaminsky of Jump Trading did.
Very exclusive, though.
It is very, it's an exclusive club. Yeah. I'm not going to say that your chances of getting on the show are greater if you do it this way, but I'm not saying it's not either. But he writes in and says, love the pod you do with Sarah. Thanks for all the great market content and context. I had to throw that in. I had to throw in the compliments. And he points out this asset. Bob, you might have some thoughts on this. We like to talk about the alternative asset space in the crazy things. And Steve is pointing out a 1952 Mickey Mantle baseball card just sold for, now let's play Price is Right, Sarah. What are you paying for a 1952 Mickey Mantle baseball card?
I can't guess because I've seen these numbers. It's not fair.
Oh, you've seen the numbers. You've seen the numbers. What's your bid, Bob?
I might pay $100, maybe.
Now let's hear what it is.
No, I'm way low. I'm not a great stock picker. I'm not a great baseball card.
Baseball card picker. Even better.
Even better.
Bob, you would not win that auction. It went for $5.2 million. And as Steve says, how does a collectible card bubble pop? I don't know. But $5.2 million for a piece of cardboard.
You remember in the tulip craze in Holland, people were paying millions of guilders for a tulip bulb. So this, I can't say this totally surprises me. But then the question is, if you're looking at 5 years, what is that tulip bulb or what is that baseball card going to be worth? If it's going to be worth more, well, you know what? It might be. If you were a tulip buyer, 5 years from the time you bought the tulip, it probably wasn't worth
it's a million dollars. Pretty unbelievable. I also want to mention, Mike brought up the podcast hotline, and I want to bring you that number in case you would like to give us a call. That's 646-324-3490. Leave us a message, and of course, we might even play it on the show.
And Sarah, that was our listeners. I'm going to give you my own crazy thing, which I promised was about Bitcoin. Now, as journalists, obviously, we're not supposed to give buy and sell recommendations on investments. And that's probably a good thing. Let's all be honest. I think I'm safe in giving this one recommendation, though. And that is, if you do buy Bitcoin and you store that Bitcoin on your own personal hard drive that's password protected, do not forget the password, okay? Tattoo it on your arm if you have to. Write it down somewhere. The Times had a story on a guy, Bob, who put all his Bitcoin, $220 million worth of Bitcoin, and he can't remember his password.
And he gets two more tries.
Yes, that's exactly right.
No more pressure. I can even outdo that, though. Forbes had a story basically quoting the BBC about a guy in Wales who threw away his hard drive with $300 million worth of Bitcoin on it 7 years ago. And he's been bugging the town in Wales. It's Newport, the city of Newport in Wales. He's been bugging them for years about letting him go explore their dump, their landfill, to try to find this hard drive. He's offered to give them, I think, a quarter of the haul if he can find it. So offered them $70 million if he lets them go and dig up this hard drive. Bob, what do you think? Would you be out there digging in the landfill for $300 million?
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it.
Mike and Sarah, if you two will join me, We can split it up three ways.
We'll suit up. We'll get out there. We'll get our little trash pickers. We'll be ready for it. And my hunch was right, Mike. I do want to say, our listener who did write in, it's at Chris MDDC. Same crazy thing as you this week. Said it's definitely craziest things worthy.
The forgotten password or the guy digging in the dump?
The forgotten password.
Yeah. It's pretty good. All right, Sarah, what do you have for craziest thing?
All right. Well, you just made me think of one more. So I'll share two then. One also on the Bitcoin spectrum, Lindsay Lohan. Someone paid her on Cameo to hype up Bitcoin. So all of a sudden, Lindsay Lohan is now out there hyping up Bitcoin. But the one that really got me this week was there's this company called Zomedica. It's a pet medicine company. And I don't know if either of you actually watched Tiger King. Back in the early quarantine days, it was my obsession. I watched it every day, ripped through those Netflix episodes. Well, Carol Baskin of Tiger King was also paid on Cameo to talk about this company, Zomedica. It was a penny stock. This company's now up 335% this year. We saw more than 1 billion shares trade in a single day. I mean, just unbelievable the types of things that you see these days.
They got their $300 worth for that camera.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about that.
How about you, Bob? Seen anything crazy this week?
There are a lot of things that are crazy going on. I must say this is one that I find difficult to answer because we at Tiedemann try to take a long-term view of what's going on, and I try to avoid short-term judgment.
Craziness, you could call it.
About craziness. We have a lot of research. We do the research about long-term trends and how they affect our clients, and I sort of stay away from the short-term issues that are funny to talk about, but don't really help to think about the kind of long-term issues that we as investors, we as a company, we as a country have to work on. So I'm more long-term inclined, but I always enjoy hearing your crazy things of the week. So I thank you.
Bob, I imagine your clients appreciate that approach too. They're not going to be impressed by you digging in the dump looking for a Bitcoin hard drive.
I don't think they will. Of course, unless I find it in the first day or so, and then
it's worth it.
I think I'll avoid the dumps of whales for the time being. But if you find it, let me know.
You'll be my first call Absolutely, hands down. But it is, it's been an absolute privilege having you on the show today. Bob Hormats, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for letting me participate in the show. It's always a fun show to be on, and I appreciate being invited.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reagan Anonymous, and you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. Also, thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges, and the head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.